A Radiance in the Gulag by Njola Sadunlata, Chapter 10, Camp Politics. Right near us, a few hundred meters away, was the male political prisoners' fifth zone. We used to correspond secretly with that concentration camp. As soon as they brought me to the camp in 1975, we found out that a Czechist agent had seriously beaten the Ukrainian poet Vashti Simonyevich Stusta, born in 1938, in revenge for the fact that they could not break his spirit. They threw him, battered and bloody, into a punishment cell, claiming that he was to blame for a fight. A torturer received a supplementary package. Learning of all this, all the Ukrainian women and I proclaimed a hunger strike, demanding that the prosecutor come and sentence the real culprit, and put Stutsa in the hospital. In our petition we wrote that we would fast until our just demand was honored. They isolated all of us, shutting us up in a ward of the psychiatric hospital. After 5 days of our fast, the prosecutor came and put Stutsa in the hospital for treatment. He had an operation for an abdominal hernia, after which they granted him a certificate as an invalid of the second class, unable to do any hard physical labor. Soon afterward, they transported Stutsa to exile. In the course of the transport, they revoked his invalid certification, as though he had become well, and transporting to Magdalen compelled him to work in the mines. Immediately after he returned from all those torments, Stutsa was tried again. Several KGB agents were summoned to Magden and testified during the trial that in Magden Stutsa had spoken out in an anti-Soviet manner. They sentenced the ill, completely exhausted, and tortured poet during interrogations they tortured him physically to 10 years of strict concentration camp and 5 years of exile without giving him an opportunity in court for final statement. In addition, he was sued for 1,000 rubles for the travel expenses of false witnesses. Andropov's Czechist pupils were walking in their former chief's footsteps. My own case, however, was not so hard. The Czechists were seriously concerned lest the details of my trial get out. Recall, they did not permit any witnesses to remain in the courtroom after testifying, and as soon as the trial was over, they transported me under special guard to the concentration camp. In Lithuania, the KGB embargoed the mail of everyone suspected of having a connection with the Chronicle of the Catholic Church in Lithuania. They did everything they could to see that my trial remained secret. The Czechists seek to escape world scrutiny. They fear the light, and they will do anything to have people live deceived by lies or paralyzed by fear. But God was good. I was able to write a description of my trial and send it out. The letter reached its final destination by hand, avoiding the snares of the KGB. A 20th-century David overcame Goliath, since he fought in the name of the Lord, and for that, to the good God alone, be glory and thanks. To the Czechists, however, it came as a great surprise. The Moscow KGB disciplined them for stupidity. The poor Czechists in Vilnius, with Lieutenant Colonel Marksevelis at their head, came to Moldova in summer of 1975, not long after I had been brought to the concentration camp, and summoned me to the warden's office. There were Mark Gables, some of the Czechists, and the editor of some paper waiting for me. At least, that was how they introduced themselves. Czechist Mark Gables said, "We have come to take you home. We will set aside the penalty on one small condition. Don't tell us whom or how, just tell us where you were able to smuggle out the news about your trial, and you'll go home free." I answered them, "I traveled a whole month to reach this paradise of yours, and I don't want to leave it without finishing my sentence. As for the thing you're interested in, I won't talk." And so they left Moldova without getting anything from me, while I learned from them that the good God had blessed my efforts. All the more active political prisoners, after they finish their concentration camp sentence, are taken away for so-called rehabilitation. They are usually taken for 2 months to where they were sentenced, in the hopes that their resistance may have been worn down, and they will be susceptible to attractive promises. The basic means used by the Czechists to deceive people are lies coated by hypocritical cordiality, and when this deception does not work, threats and fear. Soviet policy is based on lies and deceit, violence and terror. In the concentration camp, I used to join actively in all demonstrations, often acting as a liaison with political prisoners of the other concentration camp, so that life in the zone never lacked drama. It has been rightly said, "When the stomach is empty, the head is clearer." Prisoners' minds are indeed clear and inventive. The poor Czechists, in spite of all their efforts, never did discover how we found out so quickly what was going on in the other concentration camps. As revenge, even though they never caught me, at the end of my term they revoked my right to receive a 5-kilogram package. In 3 years of the concentration camp, I received only 1 5-kilogram parcel. Prisoners in the strict regime camps are not allowed to receive anything for half their term, and after that they do not break the rules and the camp administration permits it, they may receive 1 5-kilogram parcel a year, in which there must not be anything high in calories except for baked goods, butter, meat, and fish. From active prisoners, even those parcels are confiscated on the basis of fabricated allegations of violating the rules. It is only the grace of God which sustains those under sentence. That is why they are all very grateful to those who remember them in prayer. Despite repeated efforts, no letters from relatives and friends in either the United States or England ever reached Nyola. British newspapers wrote that over 200 letters sent to Nyola from England were returned. Even from Lithuania, not all letters reached the labor camp. One particular example of this is on October 31, 1975. Father Svistikas wrote Nyola a registered letter, return receipt requested. Only when he asked the Garzazi post office to inquire why the labor camp had not notified him whether the letter had been given to Saldurte, did the labor camp post office give a notice by telegram that his letter had been received on March 5th, not by Nolne Saldurte, but by camp censor Develnev. Moreover, censors removed from the letters religious pictures, Christmas and Easter greetings, even the prettier postcards. Also, not all of Nyola's letters reached their addresses. During January and February 1977, KGB censors intercepted 2 of Nyola's letters. Between March 13, 1977 and May 13, 1977, Nyola was held at the Sarunsk interrogation facilities in Mordovian ASSR. She contracted bronchitis. She often ran a high temperature. She returned from Stralsund with a more serious case of bronchitis, and again with a high temperature and complete physical exhaustion. Because she did not receive proper medical attention, this developed into bronchodilation. In the meantime, the camp food and other conditions completely undermined Nyola's strength. Her health grew worse. At the end of the winter, Nyola wrote, "I am fortunate at work since I always fill the glove-sewing quota. Now things will be somewhat harder, for I am weak. But that's a trifle. Spring is nearly here. The grasses will awaken, and with them I will find renewed strength, for we eagerly eat dandelions, pigweed, and flower blossoms. They contain vitamins and calories." Information taken from the Chronicles of October 1, 1976 and June 29, 1977. In April 1977, they took Galina Selivunchik and me from the concentration camp without telling us where or why. They treat all prisoners this way. The warden comes and tells you to prepare in 15 minutes or less for transport. Slaves are not told why or where they are being taken. Thus they drove Galina and me like cats in a bag after returning to us all our property from the storage room, as though we were never coming back to the concentration camp. When our raven stopped, it was already dark. They herded us to the third floor of a large brick building and locked us up in a small cell. Sometime later they told us to report to the doctor. I began to think that they had brought us to the psychiatric hospital in which the Czechists were constantly threatening to confine us, but it became apparent that the two of us had wound up in Sarsink, the KGB interrogation isolation prison for rehabilitation. The medical aide asked what our complaint was and took our temperature. The soldiers searched all of our property and afterward locked us both up in a larger cell. The rehabilitation began. Some soldiers escorted us to see the prosecutor. In the office were sitting 2 Czechists. One of them told me, "We will allow you to go home, and you won't have to go into exile if you promise, on your return to Lithuania, not to tell what you experienced during interrogations and in the concentration camp, if you keep quiet when you get home." I replied that I had remained silent until my arrest, because I had nothing to tell about, but now I would speak, because there was something to say. They warned me that they would make my exile 100 times more difficult than conditions in the concentration camp, and to this I replied, "The harder, the better." The Czechists glanced at one another and, surprised, said, "What character! We like you!" And they never mentioned the subject again during interrogation. They decided to try another tack. They summoned the teacher of Marxism-Leninism from the School of Higher Studies to disprove my views. The Czechists left us 2 women alone in the office to give the impression of a cordial conversation. Just about my age, she was very surprised to see me, since she did not expect that I would be so joyful and cordial to her. We began talking. I soon became convinced that she did not have the slightest notion about religion, and I said to her, "Please forgive my frankness, but back home in Lithuania, 6- and 7-year-old children know more about religion than you, who teach your students atheism. How can you deny and resist something that you do not know?" She readily agreed that she had no knowledge, and that she had not even read the gospel. She became interested when I told her about the power of prayer and God's mercy to people, and afterwards she said reflectively, "I can't believe that people would be punished for practicing their religion." "It's too bad," I replied, "that you are unable to get acquainted with my case file, which is in the offices of the Vilnius KGB. There, for 10 months, while they were interrogating me, the Czechists examined all 3 issues of the Chronicle found in my possession during the search, issues giving examples of those who had suffered from practicing their religion. They did not find a single thing to be untrue. You can't get a hold of the Chronicle to get acquainted with it, but that's not necessary. You can prove it for yourself." "How?" she asked, surprised. "It's quite simple," I explained. "Just go to the Orthodox Church in Sarsuk to pray, as though you were a believer, and you'll see that soon you'll drop your job like a hot potato." After a moment's thought, she replied that it really would be so. We did not pursue the subject, for at this point some Czechists, who had probably been eavesdropping on our conversation, came in and told us to stop talking. The instructor asked that she be allowed to talk with me again the next day, and the Czechist sternly replied, "You are not allowed. It is not you who are educating her, but she you," and I never saw her again. I just remember her and her little daughter in my prayers, since she did manage to tell me something about herself. At the Sarsenk KGB, another surprise awaited me. Galina and I were put up in a good, well-lit cell. Not in the basement, but on the 3rd floor, where we could see the tops of the trees through the window. In order to make sleeping more comfortable on the wide wooden benches used as beds, they brought us each 2 brand-new straw mattresses. They offered us each a 3rd mattress, but we declined. Besides all these privileges, they fed us very well, although one is allowed to purchase only 5 rubles of food products per month in the concentration camp. The Sarsenk KGB allowed us to purchase 30 rubles worth, or more, of course, from the money we had earned ourselves. The soldiers would bring from the shops fresh milk, cream, cheese, butter, whatever they could get. We never dreamed of such delicacies. The 2 of us were fed almost as well as a president. Galina and I joked, "Easter is near, and the Soviets have no meat, so they are fattening us up for the slaughter." They used to take us out of the prison yard for exercise when we requested, when the sun was shining, and not just for a half hour, but for 3 hours. Only the isolation prison warden asked us not to tell anyone. We did not promise. After my conversation with the instructor on atheism, I was almost never summoned for interrogation or rehabilitation. While in the concentration camp, I had become ill. I was weakened by a serious cough. For a couple of months, I was treated in the concentration camp hospital, where the food is very poor, but you don't have to work. In Sarsenk, they began to give me formal medical treatment. They took me to the polyclinic for a checkup. After that, a medical aide used to dispense foreign medication every day, and at bedtime she used to apply hot suction cups and mustard plasters. We did not have to work. During the day, we used to read books obtained in the KGB library. The cell window had 1 row of bars, and we could open it whenever we wished. The weather was good. In this way, 2 months passed, and I regained my strength, developed a suntan, and became unlike a prisoner. Then one day, the warden of the isolation prison summoned me, and a soldier escorted me. The warden said to me, "We would like to photograph you, because your brother is very concerned about your health." I refused, saying, "My brother just visited me in the concentration camp, and very soon they will transport me into exile, where he will be able to visit me again. I refuse to be photographed." I suggested that they photograph Galina, who had not seen her brother for 11 years. The warden muttered something to himself as if to say that that was not necessary, and asked again that I agree to be photographed. I refused categorically. The soldier took me back to my cell, but less than a half hour had passed when I was summoned by the prosecutor. They brought me to him. At the Sarsenk KGB, we did not wear the striped prisoners' uniforms, but our own clothing, which they returned to us from the storeroom when they transported us from the concentration camp. The soldier ushered me into the interrogation office. I was surprised to see a large decorated room, with soft chairs and large unbarred windows. Behind a round lacquered table sat 2 Czechists, while a 3rd stood on one side. All of them were smiling pleasantly. My re-educator said, "How good you look! One would think you had just returned from Paris." "And how does Sarsenk differ from Paris?" I asked him. He invited me to sit next to him on the sofa. I declined. Then they drew up an ornate armchair at the table, and I sat down. One of the Czechists began to tell me, "I come home, and I hear that my neighbor is back. I go over to see him, and I'm surprised that he has his door locked. Why? Ha ha, I say, he must have gotten his hands on a piece of meat somewhere and is in a hurry to eat it himself, so that he won't have to share it with me." I smile at the fact that the Czechists also talk about the shortage of food products in the Soviet Union. And at that instant, a light flashed. The young Czechist standing by had photographed me. Only then did I understand why the whole comedy had been put on. "Why, you're abusing your position," I said to him. "You have photographed me without my consent. God grant that my picture will not come out." The photographer, quite satisfied with the shot, replied, "I have been working here as a photographer for 4 years already, and there has never been a time when one of my shots has not come out." And with this, he left the room. My re-educator explained to the visiting Czechist, "They've made a goddess of her abroad, yelling and screaming that she's dying. Let them see how good she looks." For 2 months, the Czechists kept me as though at a resort, just to disinform those abroad. "See what our Soviet prisoners are like." The following morning, the warden of the isolation prison summoned me again, disturbed. He said, "Your picture didn't come out yesterday." He showed me a very sharp, postcard-sized photograph of me sitting in the armchair, smiling, but with bars in front of me. I'm literally sitting behind bars and smiling. There were bars across the entire photograph. The warden told me that the bars appeared because the photographer did not use the right film. He asked me to agree to be photographed again, but I refused. A soldier escorted me to my cell and after a few minutes took me to the prosecutor's office. Instead of being met by the prosecutor, I was met by the photographer from the day before, who took me into his dark room. I sat down on a simple chair at a table, and he begged me very emotionally to agree to be photographed, otherwise he would be in trouble. I began to feel very sorry for that poor Czechist, took a magazine from the table, placed it on my lap, and bending over as though reading, I said, "Now you may photograph me." He made his preparations and requested, "Raise your head and smile." And to this I replied, "Photograph me reading, or else I will not cooperate." He took the picture. "Only please never ask God again to not have my pictures come out. I believe in God too, only I don't have the strength, the willpower, or courage to admit it." The photographer himself confirmed that it had been impossible to develop my photograph in the normal fashion, not on account of the film, but because of the power of prayer. How good God is. He tries to bring the wanderers back to himself. Sometime later, I was summoned by Czechist Trusimov, who had arrived from the concentration camp in Moldova. He had been drinking considerably and boasted that he had been celebrating his 40th birthday. He invited me to be photographed with him or to accompany him to Vilnius to see the sights and other nonsense. I absolutely refused, and then in hopeless anger he said, "Who needs your sacrifice? Take everything you can get from life here and now, because tomorrow you will croak and no one will remember you." I told him that people don't croak, they die. He angrily rebutted me and continued, "You or I may already be suffering from cancer. We'll croak, they'll plant us, and everyone will forget, even our friends and relatives." How much terrible despair in the heart of a Czechist who was only 40 years old. After 2 months, Galina and I were taken via the exhausting transport back to the concentration camp. On the way, I came down with a cold, and the cough and fever, my chronic bronchitis, began to torment me again. Back at the concentration camp, I found out that the male political prisoners had refused for 3 months to carry out compulsory labor, demanding that in the Soviet Union political prisoners be classified as such. The women in our concentration camp were exhausted. No one had enough energy left to take on 3 months of new torments in the punishment cell. My sentence was the shortest. My exile in Siberia was just around the corner. So fresh from Sarsank, I wrote the concentration camp superintendent a petition demanding that we be acknowledged as political prisoners and protesting against new political arrests in Lithuania. I found out that they had arrested Vladas Lapinas. I refused to do any compulsory labor until the end of my concentration camp term, August 27, 1977. The concentration camp administration immediately summoned me to convince me to retract my statement, saying that it would be pointless and for me it would simply mean new torments in the punishment cell. They reminded me of my poor health and the fact that I faced the difficult journey to Siberia. All of your petitions and protests are just a drop in the ocean, and you will gain nothing but just ruin your health, said the superintendent. So let it be a drop to help someone else, I replied. After all, drop after drop can wear a hole in a rock. To make things easier for others, I'm ready for anything, not just the punishment cell, but even death. The recurrence of my acute bronchitis and a temperature of 100 Fahrenheit kept me out of the punishment cell, although the Czechists forbade me to be treated. Besides, male political prisoners told the administration that if I were sent to the punishment cell with a fever, they would proclaim a hunger strike. Throughout that whole time, they never gave me a single letter, and they used to confiscate my letters to my brother.